Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome back to another episode of Coffee and Crime, a true crime podcast. If you're new here, hello, my name is Lisa Marie Imray. I'm a New Zealand true crime podcaster, and each week I sit down with a cup of coffee and I tell you all about a true crime story. Before we get into today's intro and spiel and all that good stuff, I actually am going to do a little bit of an unboxing for you guys. That's so gross. That's so mainstream YouTube and all that kind of good stuff. But what I have received today did actually come from my own shop on Redbubble, which you can go and check out and find lots of different types of goodies. But I wanted to get some stuff for myself. It's my stuff. I want it. Don't come at me. And so now I'm going to do like an unboxing. Obviously, if you're listening on like the Spotify, Apple Podcast, or, you know, through your headphones, it might sound a little bit weird, but I will be posting this video part, this video segment up on my Instagram as well as photos, but just bear with me for now. So without much further ado, I'm going to open this bad boy. Let's go. I'm probably just going to speed up the audio a little bit here. So if I start sounding like a little squeaky hamster, there is nothing wrong with your headphones or anything like that. I'm just going to speed this audio up. So here we go. Seems to be quite sturdy, which is good. Ooh! Alright, let's... No! Stop! Oh, they knocked the camera over again. I'm so sorry, YouTube watchers. No! Stop! This was quite quick as well. So I'm actually really stuck. So I have got a coffee cup that's got, oh, you can just see the reflection there, Coffee and Crime logo going around. I'm going to use this in today's episode to go have a coffee out of after I wash it, but how uber cool is that? Get out! But I did get two, because if you buy two products of the same type, then you get like a special discount off them. Just letting you all know to go over. This is my favorite design that I've made, because I'm not a very creative person, but I made a couple of I think I'm going to use this one. That's the other design. It's like a fingerprint with a coffee stain around it, and underneath, Coffee and Crime, obviously. I don't know the best way to show you because it's got that awful glare on it, but I love it. I love it. I have merchandise, people. And, you know, it's good old ceramic, but it's, you know what? I love it. And it's like perfect size for a perfect cup of coffee. All right, I will be right back. I'm going to go wash these out, get all the kind of packaging, smell off them, and then I'm going to make a coffee, and I'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. Did you miss me? As you would have noticed, we've also had a costume change, and we have a nice, don't want to spill it, we have a nice cup of caramel latte in my new cup. Whoop, whoop. I had a costume change because I've literally just got home from work and I saw the package and I was like, oh, I need a coffee, and if this is what I think it's going to be, then I need to open it now. But I wanted to like record me opening it, so now I've done that. I got changed. Now I'm going to have a cup of coffee and I'm going to talk to you guys and tell you about this crazy case that I've got lined up for you. Oh my goodness. We need to crack on right into it, because one, intros are really hard to record. So I'm very grateful that I had this package here, because otherwise I would have no idea what to say. I really struggle with introductions. So there's that, and I would just want to crack on into this case. Number two, we might be running a bit long. I have got the whole thing scripted. However, I have got a part where I might have to stop it depending on how long we go today. This possibly may be a two-parter, if not more, because there is lots to cover and lots to go through. Number three, like I just said, there's lots to go through. There's a lot of moving parts. We've got lots to talk about. But I am so excited to get into today's case with you guys today. This story, if you haven't heard of the story, prepare yourself, because this has got everything a true crime junkie could ever want in this story. We have a drug kingpin. We have a serial killer. We have a love and betrayal. We have a banker and a lawyer and corrupt police and corrupt people in government agencies. It's a mind-blowing case, and I'm so excited to get into it with you guys. But also, the most exciting reason about this case, even though it's awful and it's terrible, this is just a true crime nerd getting her groove on, is because this case it's a New Zealand case. I don't know why that struggled to come out. It's a New Zealand story I'm telling you guys today. And if you don't know, I am in Aotearoa, New Zealand. But also, we are going to be travelling around the world a bit, and we're going to end up in the UK. And I'm originally from the UK. So in a very weird true crime way, this case is special to me because it's like my two homes are connected through evil people. I don't know, when I was researching this, and this took a while, I've actually been researching this case for a while, and I've come to the point where it's like, all right, let's just do it. Let's just get it out there and do it. I cannot read anything else on this. I've read all the articles, and I've watched the interviews, and I've listened to the podcasts that have already covered this, and I've listened to the interviews with the reporters who were covering this case as it broke, and everything. I have listened to everything humanly possible about this, and I've read the books, and I've read experts from the book, and reviews of the books, and people reviewing the book, and I am just ready to get into this. So instead of me telling you how ready I'm going to get into it, let's just get into it. So, lovely listeners of Coffee and Crime, grab your cup of coffee, like me in my new coffee cup, or whatever caffeinated beverage you need to get through your day, and join me as I tell you the story about the Mr. Asia Drug Syndicate of Aotearoa, New Zealand. Warning, the following episode contains adult language, discussion on drug use and overdose, domestic violence, mutilation, and murder that listeners may find disturbing. This podcast is recommended for listeners 16 years and above. Listener discretion is advised. Okay, so like I've just said a fair few times, we have got a lot of moving parts in today's story. We've got a lot of characters that we need introducing to, and a few of them are going to pop in and out of today's story. I feel like we're going to get quite chaotic today, but you know what? That's fine. That's okay. To get us started, though, we are going to talk about Terence John Clark. Now, if you know anything about the Mr. Asia Drug Syndicate, or you know the story, or whatever knowledge you have, you may be wondering why I'm starting with Terry. And that's simply because even though he is kind of the co-captain, he's the second in charge, we'll get to know about that a little bit later, as a timeline chronological sort of person, he's older, it makes sense in my brain, and to keep it not so confusing, we're going to start with him. So, Terence John Clark, he did have many aliases in his lifetime. We're going to call him Terry. He was born on November 12th, 1944 in Gisborne, which is on the east coast of the North Island in New Zealand. He was born to Leo and Jessica Clark. Now, there isn't a lot of information about his early childhood or his schooling, but I would venture to say that he was a bit of a bad boy. And the reason I say this is because by 1960, at the age of about 16, 17 years old, Terry was well known to New Zealand police as a petty criminal, wannabe gangster, a bit of a thug. He had committed multiple burglaries and car conversions. And a car conversion crime is when you steal someone's car, you change the plates, you document all these false registration forms, and then you sell it to someone else, or you steal it without the intent of keeping it keeping it for yourself. But instead of locking Terry up or putting him in some sort of juvenile delinquent's home or anything like that, the police decided to use Terry as an informant for them in order to catch other criminals. Now, this is very important that I want you to remember. Terry was a snitch for the police. All right? Just remember that. Okay? It's important. I promise. It'll come up later. The police recognized that Terry was reckless and he was manipulative and psychopathic. In fact, a quote about Clark from one of the characters that we'll meet later on, he said, quote, "Clark was like a lot of psychopaths I've met. He was the sort of bloke you'd never turn your back on, a cold, calculating, and an extremely dangerous man. But you would never get that impression the first time you met him," end quote. So he is a bad, bad guy. He was known for being very violent. He was known as being a bit of a womanizer and just being an overall douchebag to the highest degree. Now, in his early 20s, so this is about the early to mid 60s, he met and married a woman by the name of Sarah Elizabeth Taylor, who liked to go by Sally. Now, Sally and Terry, they met, they got married, and they had three children together. Now, these three children have remained anonymous, and for very good reason, so we don't know anything about them, and that is absolutely fine. I hope they are living the best lives possible, and I hope they're all doing okay. However, their marriage didn't last very long, and by 1969, 1970, they had divorced, and Terry was incarcerated. Now, Terry was serving time at Wetaka Prison, which is now called Remutaka Prison, which, fun fact of the day, it's about 23 minutes down the road from where I live. So, that's fun. But Terry was in there and he was boasting to the other criminals that he met that he was caught for breaking into a bank and trying to crack into the safe, and that he was this, like, ultimate bank-robbing gangster. Really, and because he was manipulative and could talk a big game, Terry impressed some of these criminals and actually made himself some friends. Isn't that nice? This included Jim Mahoney, Errol Hinksman, Henry Dean, Barney, Malcolm, Dave, Little Mike, Clive. But the names that I want you to remember, those are some characters in today's story, but the ones that I want you to remember are the names of Diamond Jim Shepherd, Greg Ollard, and Peter Fulcher. Those three in particular do play quite a prominent role in this case, so it just pays to remember that they met Terry while in Waitako Prison. Now, while he was in there boasting about being a bank robber, in reality, he was just a petty criminal. He had been arrested on burglary charges and receiving stolen goods, so to him it probably didn't make him sound as impressive as being like this super cool bank robber. He was no John Dillinger, let's just say, and that was episode 15-16 if you want to go check that out. I'm just putting in all the plugs today, people. I'm showing my merchandise, I'm telling you to go listen to other episodes. Who am I? Oh my goodness. I'm just getting a big head because I'm drinking a coffee out of a cup that's got my podcast name on it. Settle down, girl. Settle down. So that's what he was actually incarcerated for, and he only got about a 4-year sentence. He wasn't going to be in for very long. During Terry's time in prison, he met and married a woman by the name of Norma Fleet. Now, Norma was known as a very heavy user of heroin, and unfortunately, she was deep in the clutches of addiction, which is terrible. And she, oh God, her story is quite sad as well. At 15 years old, she was kidnapped, she was abused, she was given heroin without consent, and from then her life kind of went into a downward spiral. It's terrible. It's heartbreaking. I'm not 100% sure how they met, but they did, and they got married in a Waitako prison chapel during his time there. It was also during his time that Terry started using drugs himself. There was no reports of him using drugs before he went into prison. it wasn't until he was in there. And he started consuming Mandrax, which is a type of hypnotic drug. He did vow that he would only do it while in prison, and then once he was out, he'd be clean. But we'll come to find out that that is the biggest lie he told on this planet. Okay? Let's just put that there. But this drug, this Mandrax, was smuggled in via another inmate's mum. Thanks, Mom. My friends are gonna think I'm cool. It just blows my mind. I honestly could do about a half hour spiel about Terry's time in prison and the kind of shenanigans he got up to. I'm not going to, but essentially they had these things called parole weekends where the non-violent criminals, so the ones that were in for just like burglary or car crimes, that had no violence in them, they were allowed parole weekends where they could go and volunteer at a church or a soup kitchen, or they could just kind of spend the weekend out and about, and a lot of them would go out there just to pick up drugs and smuggle them back in. So there were a few instances where Terry was doing this and he wasn't that clever about it. He got caught a few times, and it just, yeah. Terry's time in Waitako prison was a mess, an absolute mess. However, once he was a free man in 1973, Terry decided to make some money by entering the world of drug dealing, and it was through Greg Ollard and other connections in the drug world where Terry was linked up with Christopher Martin Johnston. Now, if you know the story of Mr. Asia, the drug syndicate, that name should ring a bell to you. I mean, so should Terry Clark, but that is a bit of a bigger name because Marty, as he went by, Christopher Martin Johnston, he is the captain of today's story. However, before we get into meeting Marty, there are a few things that I want to wrap up in Terry's little timeline, if you will, just because it would confuse us if we talked about it later. So he got out in 1973. He's married to a woman named Norma. However, Norma died under mysterious circumstances in 1975, 2 years after he was released. Her death was ruled a drug overdose on heroin. However, many believe, including investigators, that Terry had a hand in her murder. In fact, Peter Fulcher, who we've just met, he was in Waitako prison with Terry. He said in an interview later on that he was asked if Norma was murdered, and his response was, quote, "No comment. I know a lot about it, but put it this way, I was one of the first people to know she had died," end quote. So it's all very suspicious, but unfortunately she was known as a heavy user, and there was just no way to prove one way or another whether it was an accidental overdose, a purposeful overdose, or whether she was murdered by Terry. Coincidentally though, as soon as Norma died, Terry seemed to move on quite quickly. He met and married another woman by the name of Maria Muhari, and they went on to have another child. Now this child, his name is Jared. He is a bit more, well, he is known, like I said, we know his name, and he did a few interviews later on about his dad being Terry Clark, who you guys are going to get to know quite well today, but we don't really need to go too much into his kids. I'm sorry guys, but you had a really bad man as a father, and I hope that you're all okay, but anyway, and at some point in the late 1970s, Terry and Maria just kind of separated and split. But that's just some of Terry's marriages that I just wanted to wrap up, because if I just mentioned it later on, it, you know what I mean? That's what happened. He got out, he was married, his wife Norma died, he met another woman, had a kid, and they split off. And this was all within the 1970s. Cool. Now, even though that was the end of his marriages, it was not the end of his lovers, but they will play a part in kind of a timeline order. So we can now put a pin in Terry and we can move on to Marty, because like I said, he is the captain of today's story. So Christopher Martin Johnston was born in Takapuna, Auckland, which is situated near the top of the North Island, in 1951 to Brian and Aileen Johnston. We are going to call him Marty because even though I like the name Christopher, I don't want to use that with him. We'll call him Marty. Now, like Terry, information about Marty's childhood is pretty much unknown, but we know that he went to Takapuna Grammar Secondary School. Now, I don't know Takapuna Grammar. I'm not from that area. Obviously, I'm down in Wellington. So I wanted to do a little bit of research into what the school was like to maybe give us an idea of what Marty's home situation was like, possibly trying to make some connections. And since Takapuna is a very expensive, high standard school, I would venture to say that maybe his family were doing quite well, and he was from a maybe not an overly wealthy family, but a family that was doing okay. You know what I mean? But it was actually quite funny because as I was looking into this information, I came across a list of Takapuna Grammar's noteworthy alumni, past students, and most of the people on this list were rugby players, which comes as no surprise as rugby is the biggest sport in New Zealand. But there was like cricket players, there was TV hosts and radio hosts, there was a few cabinet ministers, there was even some singer-songwriters and some famous ones like Jen Wigmore and Ella Yalick O'Connor, who you might know as Lord. She came out with the banger back in, what was it, 2015 maybe, Royals. That song and many, many others, and she went to Takapuna Grammar. So I was like, oh, nice, this is, they produce some pretty cool people. And I was going through this list, and on the list was Marty Johnston, and next to it it said Mr. Asia, drug dealer. So he's on this list with all these super successful and, like, by all accounts, very nice people, and there's Marty Johnston, drug dealer. It's like, even though you were a, like, an awful person, you made the list, Marty. I'm so proud of you. Like, way to go, dude. But yeah, I just thought that was quite funny. So Marty, he went through and completed his education at Takapuna. And when he left school, he did start working as a farmhand, but he realized that he didn't really want to do that. He loved fashion. He had a passion for fashion. Bratz. Was it the Bratz or was it? No, it wasn't Barbie. The Bratz. The Bratz had a passion for fashion, and so did Marty. Marty was a looker. He was very handsome. He liked to dress well. He liked to feel good. And he liked to be told that he looked good. You know what I mean? I mean, we can all appreciate someone who puts effort into their appearance, and that's what Marty did. I'm not gonna lie, he looked good. Good on him. So because farming was not his cup of tea, he decided to look for a job in retail, specifically menswear. And he started working at a shop called Collar and Cuff, which was situated on Queen Street in the very busy Auckland CBD. Now, if you have been with Coffee and Crime for a long time and you listened to episode 4 of Kayo Matsuzawa, she was a Japanese tourist who unfortunately was murdered and her body was found on Queen Street near the BNZ Bank. It is still unsolved to this day. It's a crazy case. Episode 4. Check it out. But I gave, in that episode, I gave a little bit of information about Queen Street, Karangahape Road, otherwise known as K Road, and a little bit of New Zealand tourist information, if you will. But just to quickly recap that, Queen Street is one of the busiest streets in Auckland. It's known for its shopping stores, its foodies. Right next to it, Karangahape Road is known for its nightlife. It's a very, very busy street, and it drew in a lot of customers, and Marty, being the charismatic and charming man that he was, did really well for himself as a retail worker. Marty's father, Brian, actually owned his own menswear store called Esquire Menswear, and so it was at a much higher standard, if you will. And because Marty had developed this interest in fashion, which I would venture came from his father, if his father had his own menswear store, Marty actually started working as a salesman in Esquire Menswear for his father. So a little bit of a family business thing going on there. While he was working in these menswear stores, Marty met a Scotsman by the name of Andrew Mayer, who also was working alongside him. Now, we need to drill this name into our heads, okay? Andrew Mayer. Andy. And the reason why is because Marty and Andy were the best of friends. And this is what we need to know. Okay? They were best friends. Just remember that, okay? Now, these two, they were working together. They were hanging out all the time. They were loving their life. They're like late teens, early 20s at this point. They're doing what they want. They're working. They're looking good. They're wearing three-piece suits. And they're just having a ball. But they aren't making any money. There's no money to be made in retail. Like, you can't make it big unless you make it big. You know what I mean? Like, you have to get past the grunt stages and then the managers who don't really make that much, and you have to deal with all the kind of like shitty customers and the rubbish workers who've got no work ethic, and then you have to get higher and higher and higher. And once you've made it, that's where the good money comes in. But very young Marty was like, nah, not having it. I want to make some money and I want to make it now. So Marty and Andy would start stealing, and they would start going around burglarizing, and then they would sell the stolen goods to people in pubs and in back alleys, really. Anyone who saw any value in what they had stolen. Now, because Marty was manipulative, essentially, and charming, and he would dress well, he actually introduced himself as an international businessman, and that he would trade with people overseas. And he was very arrogant and very cocky. So to a lot of people, they were like, he's the real deal. And this is where he started pulling in a little bit of money. However, it came apparent to Marty that the real money, like the best money that you could make, was in the world of drugs, specifically marijuana. Now, I want to put a little pin in our story here because I need to give you all some context regarding the history of drugs in New Zealand, because we are talking about a drug syndicate here, and this is the very early days of marijuana and drugs in New Zealand. So I just kind of wanted to give you all a little bit of a backstory just so we understand a few things. So marijuana didn't take off in the early days of New Zealand colonization by the British. That just wasn't really a thing. It never came over. It wasn't imported. And it wasn't until 1950s, 1960s, so about 60, 65 years ago, that people started to take notice of this drug. It was being imported on merchant ships, but it was very exclusive back then. And it was for those in the jazz scene or artists, or the people bringing it over on the merchant ships would just have it for themselves, because why not? They're bringing it, they can have it. There were a few crimes that occurred where marijuana use was involved, and then marijuana awareness kind of grew and people started to learn a bit more about it. Pop culture that was finally making its way to New Zealand shores was starting to incorporate the talk of marijuana and drugs, and then there was kind of the hip hop scene, the rap scene, and all that kind of stuff. And that was finally making its way to New Zealand. Because we are so geographically isolated, we're very late to all the good stuff, essentially, if you'd like. But then in 1964, the Beatles did a tour of New Zealand, and we all know what the Beatles are really singing about in their songs. So again, more awareness around different types of drugs. Also in 1964, the first drug squad was formed within the New Zealand police. So then people were like, all right, this is something. This is a naughty thing that people shouldn't be doing. And then as we started to learn what it looked like, what it smelled like, what it could do, people were realizing that it was growing in their own backyard, and they just had no idea what it was. But then they found out what it was, and they're like, ah, sweet. It's in my backyard, and my neighbor next door wants to buy it from me. Money? Yes, please. And essentially, that's how drug dealing got started. And this was all going through the 1960s. So by the time that Marty kind of fell into the drug scene, it was early 1970s, and marijuana was starting to really, really take off. Just as a fact of the day, if you didn't know, recreational marijuana use in New Zealand is still illegal. We had a referendum a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, to legalize it, but it did not pass. It is very commonly used, though, that is no secret. And medicinal marijuana has started to go through trials and become available to people and things like that. But pulling it back to the story today, that's just a little bit of information. So by the time that, like I just said, by the time that Marty kind of found the world of drugs, marijuana had taken off, but it was still in its early days. But that's where the money was to be made. So Marty and Andy, they're trying to find out how they could cash in on this habit that people would start to pick up, and this thing that was kept very secret, but not so secret as well, because of all the baby boomers and the hippies were just out there. They love to get high and they love to kind of spread it around, all that kind of stuff. So they wanted a slice of this. And during their venture in becoming drug dealers, they met a man called Chu Cheng Kui, otherwise known as Chinese Jack. Don't know why they called him Chinese Jack, because by all accounts, he was from Singapore. He might have originally been from China, but like I said, all accounts said he was from Singapore. He was a Singaporean ship steward. But not only was he a ship steward, he was also a drug smuggler. So Jack Chu, that was another name that he went by, which I think is a lot better, because I'm not calling him Chinese Jack. That just feels a little bit racist to me, and we don't like racism here. Jack Chu was smuggling Buddha sticks into New Zealand. Now, a Buddha stick is, it's a variety of marijuana that was originally from Thailand that has been dried slowly, and then it's kind of like bundled and wrapped around thin bamboo splints and then fastened together with hemp string. Now, this variety of marijuana was far more potent and very strong compared to what was growing in New Zealand at the time. So when people started to get these Buddha sticks that were being smuggled into New Zealand, they became very popular very quickly. And with the rise in popularity came the rise of price. Gonna have a little math lesson here, which is just super fun, but this will blow your mind. Well, it blew my mind. I'm probably just a very simple person, but this was wild to me. So in Singapore in 1970, a Buddha stick cost 9 cents in Singaporean currency. That was equivalent to about 10 cents in New Zealand currency. So very, very cheap. However, Marty was selling a Buddha stick for 10 New Zealand dollars in the 1970s. $10 in 1970 would be equivalent to $192 today, New Zealand dollars today. So it was very expensive for back in those times, and it was obviously a lot more expensive than it was in Singapore, where they're essentially from. So he was making some big bucks off these, but he also had to pay some money of the cut to Jack, so of course he's going to charge it for a bit more, but it's just crazy that it's actually that much more expensive. But we're going to get even wilder now, because I went on a little bit of a rabbit hole with these prices and conversions and stuff. It's crazy. If a Buddha stick was sold for 10 Singapore dollars in 1970, that would be equivalent to 35 Singapore dollars today. And 35 Singapore dollars today is equivalent to 40 New Zealand dollars today. So it just kind of goes to show that New Zealand's inflation rate went massive, because $10 to $192 in New Zealand, where it's only $10 to $35 in Singaporean currency, it's just like, whoa, like what? So yeah, it just goes to show New Zealand inflation rate is unreal. And also Marty was making some big bucks off these Buddha sticks. The way that Marty, Andy and Jack Chu got the Buddha sticks into New Zealand was, as the ship that Jack worked on, as it passed through the Rangitoto Channel, which, more New Zealand geography for you, it comes in from the north, underneath the Harbour Bridge and into Auckland Harbour. So as it was coming through the Rangitoto Channel, Jack would toss the bags of Buddha sticks overboard. Marty and Andy would go in a boat, go out to retrieve them and bring them ashore. And they did this because they didn't want to have to go through any inspections or customs. Even though they're not as effective as they are today, it just minimized that potential risk. Makes sense. And this, through this water retrieval method of this very potent marijuana, it pretty much made Marty a very popular, if you will, and prominent drug king in New Zealand. And this little hustle, side hustle, if you will, continued on for a few years through this method. But as it started to grow and more people became aware, and obviously marijuana awareness grew and drug usage grew, Marty's customers wanted to buy bulk amounts. And that means he needed to operate at a larger scale. And when doing that, he couldn't just do that with his best mate Andy from the menswear store. He had to get a few more people involved. He had to find out who he could trust, who he could bring into this operation. And people wanted to. He didn't have to threaten anyone. People were raising their hands to get a slice of this cake. And that's how, in 1973, Marty and Terry got linked up through drug connections, but also through Greg Ollard, who we met back when we talked about Terry. Now, to give a little information, at this point, Marty is very early 20s. He's about 22, 23 years old at this point, and he is doing very well financially for himself. Terry was 29, 30 years old. He wanted to make some serious dough, and because he was a little bit older, he knew the police, because he was a snitch, he knew how they worked. It sort of made sense to partner up and continue to import, sell, and distribute the Buddha sticks throughout New Zealand. They used Terry's friends, Greg, Jim, Dave, Barney, Malcolm, Little Mike, and others that he met in Waitago Prison, to become the distributors throughout New Zealand and the couriers, and to drive it around and to sell it and to get the profit. And this is where the little group started to form. These are very, very early days. However, the water retrieval method that Marty, Andy, and Jack Chu had going was starting to get a little bit erratic, and it started to bring unwanted attention from the authorities, because there was a rise in drug-related charges and arrests, such as possession and distribution. Police were noticing and keeping tabs on multiple little drug operations around the country. So the water retrieval method, it's just what I'm going to call it because I have no idea what else to say, it just became too risky. And Marty and Terry decided that they needed to cut the middleman, Jack Chu, and go international. Go and get the goods from the source themselves. And this is what they did. After years and years of working with Jack Chu, about 3 or 4 years of working with Jack Chu, bye-bye, no more. I don't know if he took the news very well, but that's decided what they wanted to do. But how on earth are Marty and Terry going to go all the way to Thailand, pick up a huge amount of Buddha sticks and import them and smuggle them back into New Zealand? Well, crazy story. Brian, Marty's father, had a yacht. Well, okay, this is the story. It's weird, it's wild, and I can't get my head around it. So, there was a musical called The Brigadoon, and it was about a fictional Scottish village called The Brigadoon. So there was that, The Brigadoon, that's where I'm getting at. Then in the mid-late 1960s, there was a large version of a design for a yacht that was going to be called The Brigadoon. And Brian, Marty's father, he saw this design, loved it, and commissioned for a smaller version to be made for him. And in 1969, his dream became a reality, and he had a 45-foot yacht called the Brigadoon. However, in 1972, the ship was sold and bought by an unknown buyer, and then in 1975, the unknown buyer sold it to a Marty Johnston, who was the original owner's son. So, just crazy how it like ended up going back to the Johnston family anyway. Now, we don't know if this was like genuinely an unknown buyer, we just don't know who it was, or if it was like a plant that Marty had put, like, can you buy this boat off my dad? We don't know why Brian even wanted to sell it in the first place, if he got it made for him. I don't know. But it went from Brian to someone else, back to Marty, so it stayed in the family. Mental. So Marty had arranged for a very large order of Buddha sticks to be picked up in Bangkok in Thailand, and he sorted out a crew to take the Brigadoon to get it, smuggle it back ashore at a Northland beach. Couldn't be more simple. Go get it, bring it back, meet at this point. Nothing can go wrong. Yeah. No. When I tell you, this voyage was cursed from the beginning. You gotta believe me. I cannot make this story up about what happens to this this voyage, this journey. So to start us off, the crew that Marty had found were pretty much a couple of his mates and his mates' mates who had little to no experience when it came to sailing. The skipper navigated erratically around the place and sailed the Brigadoon into a maze of reefs in just northwest of Nomea. And if you need some kind of geographical picturage, New Zealand's, you know, at the bottom of the Pacific, and then right next to it's Australia. Nomea isn't even like further north than the most northern part of Australia. Like it's still like so close to New Zealand. It's crazy. You'll have to get a photo if you don't know, but it's not that far away. Yes, there was no GPS back then and they had to use the maps and the stars to guide the way, but like, what? Anyway, so they are traveling northwest of Nomea and they hit a maze of reefs, and the skipper ran the Brigadoon aground at least 6 times, meaning he got it stuck and they had to kind of try and get it out in ways, or wait for the waves to take it, wait for the tide, or they had to kind of get other boats to get it away. They ran it aground 6 times. Now, because this obviously meant that the trip was going to take longer than planned, the meat and perishables that were aboard went off and rotten, and the crew got sick. But not just from the meat and the food going off, 2 of the crew members got seasick. 2 of the sailors got seasick. Like, how useless do you have to be to be a sailor who gets seasick? That just makes me laugh. I'm like, you have one job. You've decided that your life is going to be as a seaman, and you go and you get seasick. Like, bro, rethink your life. now that they were pretty much stuck near Nomea, they decided, well, they might as well stop there to replenish the boat. However, while they were in Nomea, one of the crew members got caught shoplifting and he was arrested. When the local authorities ran his credentials and found that he was from New Zealand, they did get in contact with the New Zealand police about extraditing him back or whether they could keep him. They spoke to New Zealand police. And the New Zealand police actually told them to let them go because the Brigadoon was actually under surveillance for smuggling drugs. And New Zealand police wanted to see what was going to happen with the Brigadoon, and they wanted to like catch it in the act when it came back into New Zealand shores. And so they were like, let them go. It's fine. We'll handle it from here. Go on. Which is like insane, because if New Zealand police were like, yeah, no, hold him, this would be a completely different story. But that crew member was released and the Brigadoon was set off for Bangkok, and eventually they made it. And when they got to Bangkok, they were escorted by heavily armed Thai guards or from the police to a fortified village where the marijuana was picked, dried and compressed. The order that Marty made was for 450,000 Buddha sticks. Every square inch of spare space in that yacht was stowed with 40 bales of marijuana and was like packed to the brim. The brim! Now, I've just told you that they were escorted by police. Now, there are conflicting reports about this. Not that they definitely were escorted, but the reason as to why is conflicting. Most reports say that they were paid off. And we're going to see a lot of that. It's a reoccurring theme. They were paid off to escort them to go get the drugs. The other reports were saying that New Zealand police were in touch with the local authorities in Thailand and said, let them do what they want. Turn a blind eye. Take a bribe. We want the Brigadoon to come back home and we want to catch these criminals. So, were they paid off? Were they informed to be paid off? We'll never know. But that's why they were escorted to the village where they got this huge amount of marijuana onto their boat. So then they were on their way home, but this cursed cruise was not out of the dark yet. 2 of the crew members caught malaria and needed immediate medical attention. The closest place they could go for this was Indonesia. However, they could not go to Indonesia with 450,000 Buddha sticks. No, no, no. So they literally had to find a nearby island, dump the marijuana they had just picked up there, and sail on to Makassar in Indonesia. Now, luckily, the crew members that got malaria were allowed to enter and were taken to get medical attention right away. However, the Brigadoon and the rest of its crew was held in prison for entering Indonesia without a visa. That's pretty crap, but if they were found with that amount of marijuana in their yacht, they would have all been executed. So I think they got off okay with just being held for 3 weeks. Now, the malaria-ridden crew did make a full recovery. However, they weren't then thrown in jail with the rest. They had to find a way to pay for the crew to be released so that they could get back on their way home. And the way that they decided to, or the way they were able to make money, was to become performers entertaining at a tourist hotel. They had to perform for tourists coming in, even though essentially they were tourists themselves. But can you imagine, like, these two guys standing there, they've just had malaria, they've just been in Indonesia, they probably don't understand anyone. And it's like, hey Steve, you got any talents? Bob, I'm a sailor who gets seasick. I'm the most useless person. I've got no talent. Well, Steve, we've got to do something. Sorry, I just think that's so funny. But they did, like, they had to perform, and then they were able to raise enough money to have the crew released, have the Brigadoon released, and they could finally get on their way home. But we're not out of the dark yet. As the Brigadoon was coming from Indonesia down the Timor Passage towards Northern Australia, they once again ran aground about 3 or 4 more times. Like, can the skipper not drive a ship? Like, come on, just, it's like a car. Stay away from the curbs, man. Like, use your eyes. No, I can imagine it is very difficult to run a ship and to drive a ship. So, you know, mad respect. I'd probably never get it out of the bay, but you know, that just makes me laugh so much. They finally entered Northern Australia territory, where they were towed the rest of the way to New Zealand by an old Asian fishing vessel because the skipper could no longer be trusted. Honestly, would do like a drug test on that guy. Doesn't help that he's sailing with about 450,000 Buddha sticks on board, and who knows how many they had themselves. Oh my goodness. But they were towed the rest of the way, and as they got towards the drop-off point at a North Shore beach, once again, the Brigadoon ran aground, and Marty was over it. They were so late on returning. Like, they were held for 3 weeks. They were meant to be back in New Zealand, and they weren't. They were held for 3 weeks, so when they ran aground again, Marty was over it. He's like, where the hell have you guys been? And he gets on a powerboat, and he drives out to the Brigadoon, and he's like, just give me the weed, man. Just give me the marijuana. And he starts loading it up on the boat, and he's going to do trips back and forth from the shore to drop it off, go get another round, come back, blah, blah, blah. However, as he's doing this, the engine dies on his powerboat. So then the next option was to get an inflatable dinghy from the boat, like a life-saving boat, and manually row the weed to and from the shore and to the vessel, to the Brigadoon. So, yeah, he was determined, man. I'll hand it to Marty. He was determined to make this work, and Terry was there helping him, of course, and it's just like, the amount of times he was capsized because he was in an inflatable dinghy and going over waves that were tossing him out. Oh my goodness. Like, if you needed any more red flags to stop doing something, I don't. This was the most, and you can't make any of that up. I'm speechless. When I was reading the few reports and the accounts and all that about this voyage, I was like, the hell? How are we? I have no words. But like I said, Marty and Terry were determined to make this Asian expansion work, where they would go directly to the importer, directly to the supplier, bring it back themselves, cut out the middleman. They were determined for this to work, and it did pay off. The revenue they got from this shipment of 450,000 Buddha sticks was around 3 million New Zealand dollars, which today would be 35,355,568 New Zealand dollars. These boys were richy rich. Like, they were... they were very well off from this... Oh, I'm just shocked. I'm just so speechless because this is so insane. This is... They were very rich. Now, New Zealand police had not caught the Brigadoon, as they were hoping to do when they let them go in Noumea, and when they maybe or maybe not contacted the Thai authorities, possibly because they didn't plan on spending 3 weeks in Indonesia. The New Zealand police did not catch the Brigadoon, and the Buddha sticks were imported and distributed all over New Zealand through the likes of Jim Mahoney, Errol Hendrickson, Henry Dean, Malcolm, Barney, and all the people that Terry met in Waitako prison, and obviously Andy Mayer was still involved as well. Marty's best friend, let me just remind you. You'll understand why. When I get to it, you'll understand why I keep saying it like that. But now they were getting all this money in, and you can't just sit there with $3 million in your bank accounts. Obviously, it was over time, and they had to then pay the crew, they had to pay, obviously, the supplier themselves, they had to pay the distributors, everyone for their troubles. But they had a lot of cash left over, and Marty and Terry knew they needed to be smart about it, but unfortunately, neither of them were smart people. They didn't quite know what to do. Marty looked the part of the businessman, but he had no business brains, essentially, and Terry was kind of the muscle, but he was also a charmer as well. So not the best pair to match up, because you kind of need brains and brawns, but you kind of only had two sweet talkers, I suppose. But they did make a smart decision, and they hired a banker, and this was Diamond Jim Shepherd. Now, if you remember, he served time in Waitako prison alongside Terry. That's how they met. He was a career criminal at this point. He had done some pretty awful things. He was actually the one who said the quote about Terry at the beginning, about him being a psychopath, if you remember. That was Diamond Jim who said it. He was called Diamond Jim because he wore a diamond ring on his finger. That's what they did. But he was money smart, and so he became the banker for Marty and Terry. He would move the money to offshore accounts. They would buy properties in Bay of Islands and Fiji and use them as cash houses, where they would stash the cash there. Stash the cash. They would put it into their own bank accounts, into family's bank accounts. They were just very smart about moving the money around. And this was nothing that anyone thought anyone from New Zealand could do. You know what I mean? It was just crazy. I will start to preface now. We'll talk more about this in a little bit. And I do believe we are going to be doing two parts today. We're not quite at the end of part one yet, but I'm just looking at the time and how long I've been recording, and I'm just, yeah. So we are going to be doing a two-parter, but I just want to start prefacing that the distributors and couriers, not only were they friends that Terry made while serving time at Waitako prison, but they were also young, attractive females that Marty and Terry, the playboy womanizing men, would lure in with the promise of love and sex and drugs. And they would use these women because they were easier to get through customs or any kind of inspections. And we will discuss a little bit more about that. But just so you know, there were a lot of women involved in the early days as well. It was also around the time of the shipment. This was happening in 1975. And if you remember, in 1975 is when Norma Fleet, Terry's second wife, this is when she died. Not sure if it was before or after this. We don't know, but that's why I didn't want to kind of go through and then say, oh, by the way, she died at this point. Like, it needed its own little segment to be said, and that's why I did that. But they both had a way with the ladies, and they got ladies involved in this operation as well. But the way that they were starting to pull this organization together was unreal. Like, it was nothing that anyone had ever seen before. And due to our geographical isolation, the big drug cartels, you know, you think like the Mexican cartel and others like that, they never saw New Zealand as a viable market or as someone they would want a partnership. And they would be sorely mistaken because, like, even though these are a bunch of bad people, they did unbelievable stuff. And, like, you would never think that the small island at the bottom of the South Pacific Ocean would be able to do what these guys pulled off. Now, Marty and Terry, they took this Asian expansion slash cursed voyage, if you will, as a win, as a success. And I mean, I would too if I was $3 million richer from it, but it's a, I suppose it's quite a subjective matter. I think it was a massive fail, but you know, I'm not $3 million richer, that's why I'm salty about it. But Marty and Terry wanted to go bigger now. They were like, all right, we can smooth out some kinks, but this could work. How do we make more money? And the idea of importing and distributing heroin, that conversation came into play. And when you go from marijuana to heroin, that is a completely different ballgame, man, in terms of like what type of drug it is and also what it does to consumers of the drugs. Don't want to mess with heroin, man. Like, don't do drugs. But like, if you're going to do drugs, don't do heroin or meth or anything. Like, just don't do weed. That's just my advice for you. Take it if you want. But like I said, they needed to sort out some kinks. They needed a much smoother operation. And this avenue of drug dealing and distributing heroin became a reality when Marty reconnected with Jack Chu. Remember the middleman that they cut out 2 years prior, the Singaporean ship steward? Marty reconnected with Jack Chu because he allegedly had some connections to some very powerful opium warlords that were situated in the Golden Triangle and would send Marty in the right direction to meet the right people. The Golden Triangle, very quickly, and yes, this is pulled from Wikipedia, I'm very sorry, but I was rushing and I was like, oh, I haven't explained what the Golden Triangle is, but this is what Wikipedia says, don't come at me. The Golden Triangle is the area where the borders of Thailand, Laos, and Myanmar meet, and there is access to all three of those countries via the Ruwik and Mekong rivers. Essentially what that is. Myanmar was producing 25% of the world's opium at this point. 25%! Is that not crazy? And it's like, it's not like the biggest country there is. It's a very tiny country. But they would produce 25% of it and then they would distribute it between Laos and Thailand, and then people would go there to pick up from the supplier, they would import it or export it from there, and that's why it was called the Golden Triangle. But like, that's crazy. So the plan for Terry and Marty and everyone involved now was to go down this avenue of distributing heroin. But to make it as smooth as possible, the plan was for Marty to move to Singapore and be the contact out there, the head honcho, the drug kingpin. He would go there, he would deal directly with the suppliers, and then he would distribute and he would send ships and he would organize all that from the suppliers, from the Golden Triangle itself. He would then distribute and send some to Australia, and he would send it to Greg Ollard, if you remember from Waitako Prison. Greg Ollard and his girlfriend, Julie Thelman, they would move to Sydney and they would become a head of the distribution in Australia. And then Marty would also send some of this heroin to Terry, who was going to stay in Auckland, and he was going to run the distribution via throughout New Zealand. And so all these thugs and other criminals and their friends would split between Australia and New Zealand, and they would help, and then they would bring these girls in to be their couriers, and then that's how they would get it around all of Australia and all of New Zealand. But it was Greg in Australia and Terry in New Zealand and Marty being in Singapore like that. Once they agreed and they made the moves, so yes, indeed, Marty went to Singapore, Greg and his girlfriend Julie went to Sydney, Terry stayed in Auckland, the group went into overdrive. They were importing high-grade Thai heroin from Southeast Asia and distributing it all over Australia and New Zealand. And this is the birth, the true birth of the Mr. Asia drug syndicate. The weed, the whole curse voyage we just learned about, that was a practice run. That was nothing. $3 million we made from that? Yeah. Loose change. It's not what we want. That was nothing. Like, to me, I would be, like, crapping myself the whole time. I would be like, I don't want to do this. And now these boys are like, let's go bigger. Let's do more. And so they decided heroin was the way to go. They decided that you don't make money in the grass, you make it in the junk. And that's what they decided to do. So they spread around Singapore, Australia, New Zealand. They got their contacts in place. And this is the birth of Mr. Asia Drug Syndicate. And that, my lovely listeners, is where I'm going to leave us off for this week, because we're already about an hour long and I have to edit, and I just know that if I continue now, we'll be here for another 2-3 hours, and I ain't doing that to y'all, because we need to break this down. We need to talk about it in a more cohesive way. So even though this didn't really involve much exciting crime, except a bit of burglary, a bit of drug smuggling. There was the mysterious death of Norma Fleet, of course. This is the origins. This is the introduction that y'all needed. You needed the background on Terry and Marty. You needed the background on the history of drugs in New Zealand. And hopefully that's what I've delivered for you guys. So, we're gonna leave it there. I'm sorry. I'm actually kind of annoyed at myself. I'm looking at the rest of the script like, y'all have no idea what's coming. You guys are not ready. So I'm sorry if you actually found today a little bit boring. Sorry. Come back next week and I promise it's going to get a lot better. It will get a lot better. But that is all from me. I'm going to wrap this up quickly because, you know, I don't want you guys to forget what I've just said. So thanks for coming. Thanks for joining me. And I can't wait to see you all next week as we tackle the second part of the Mr. Asia drug syndicate. We're going to talk about what they did. We're going to talk about a few of their bigger crimes. We're going to talk about some nasty thing that happened. We're going to talk about how it all came apart, the aftermath. Guys, next week is going to be a ride, but thank you so much for joining me. You can get in touch with me on Instagram or Facebook at Coffee and Crime Podcast. You can get yourself a cute little coffee cup like the one I have. It's still actually a little bit hot. From Redbubble, you can search up Coffee and Crime Pod and you can get yourself coffee cups, you can get yourself t-shirts, jerseys, pins, phone cases. I mean, if you want, that was just a cool thing. You can get stickers and magnets if that's more your thing. You can get whatever you like. Just go and check the store out. But if you want to discuss with me anything on today's episode, please get in touch on Facebook or Instagram. The DMs are always open for you guys to slide in. Yeah, I think I've covered everything. Thank you guys for coming today. I really do appreciate it. But until next time, be safe, be good, be better, and all that cheesy crap. And I will catch you guys next week for the second part of the Mr. Asia Drug Syndicate right here at Coffee and Crime.